Hey folks, Rob Wolf here, the ever large and in charge, Greg Everett. Greg, what's going on?
I'm just trying to not screw this up. I feel like I'm doing everything I possibly could almost wrong so far this morning, but I'm catching it at the last minute. So,
dude, you and me both.
Feeling good.
I was at Blog World yesterday and then flew into Reno last night at like 1:30, and I'm running on vapors. So I've got super sweaty palms from drinking too much coffee. So
awesome.
Eesh. Yeah.
That'll be good. That means your jaw's going to be working overtime today. I like that.
Yeah. Probably just spewing inaccuracies, but perfect. You know, that's what we're good at.
That's so, my favorite kind of podcast.
Seriously, anything new? Anything exciting? Folks need to know.
Oh, geez, I wish I had something exciting to say, but I really feel like there's nothing going on right now.
Coming up,
I have like so many things in the pipeline right now, and I think I mentioned this a couple podcasts ago. I don't like talking about them until they're done. Because I feel like that just
jinxes it,
yeah, and just sets me back even farther. So look forward to some possible new things sometime in the unspecified near future.
In an entirely undisclosed manner.
They may or may not be interesting to you.
It sounds like a drug deal. We may have something for you, or we may not.
Yes. Boy. So cool. How about you guys?
Just did Blog World, which was cool. Got to hang out with some cool folks there. That was at the LA Convention Center. And then I flew up to Reno because it looks like we're going to be moving here. So, we kicked around a couple of different spots. I know I threw out Seattle as a potential spot, but it was kind of funny.
I don't know if
it was God like trying to intervene, but the day after I threw that out to the world, we had 5 days straight of overcast and rain in Santa Fe, which like never ever happens. And I was fully like ready to you know, do the Kurt Cobain thing. And I was like, okay, we need to live someplace with sun. So yeah. Reno's cold, but it's Nikki's dad lives here. We're 2.5 hours from the gym, and we've got some projects brewing with the gym that we need to be closer to develop. But Reno will in fact be the first town that I've lived in that has a legitimate airport. So that's going to be amazing. So
that's very helpful, I can tell you.
Yeah. After like 5 years of doing like 25 to 30, you know, trips a year and living in Chico, where it's just we had better airport in Nicaragua when we were staying there. So it was, we literally, like I calculated, we could go anywhere from, we were 45 minutes outside of Managua, Nicaragua, and I figured out going to like San Francisco, LA, New York, Chicago, Atlanta, I could go from third world country Nicaragua scene to anywhere in the United States faster than I could out of Chico. But yet we still spent 8 years there. I mean, it's a good little town, but bad airport. So
yeah. I just liked how the guy who checked you in is the same guy who went through your bags, and then the same guy who loaded the bags on the plane.
Totally.
It's like,
yeah,
two employees in the whole place, and that's including the pilot.
What was the kids program where the guy would like change costumes all the time? And I forget what
all
it was.
But
yeah, that was pretty much it. Yeah.
Okay.
So that's all the news that I've got.
Well, that's exciting.
Yeah.
It's too bad they're not filming Reno 911 anymore. Mr. Window.
Yeah. Maybe the reunion show. Yes. Possibly. Yeah.
Cool. All right. You ready to answer some incredible questions?
Do the silliness? Sure. We've got a few goodies in here. Folks may not know, but we now have a Squatchy doing some work, doing some triaging of emails, and so if the questions are good, then you can blame him, or if they suck, you can also blame him.
Yeah,
so
I take no responsibility either way.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to read.
No, he's doing a great job.
Oh,
doing a good job,
okay.
So far.
All right. David says, I want to live a long life, but don't want to go down the road of calorie restriction. Eating small amounts of food and looking gaunt and skinny and being hungry all the time isn't for me. I've reviewed some of the scientific literature regarding the amino acid composition of meat, eggs, and dairy, and I see some evidence that eggs in particular are high in 3 amino acids that are associated with ill health and shorter lifespans, methionine, tryptophan, and cysteine. Studies have shown that restricting these 3 amino acids found in meat and eggs is just as effective for extending life as restricting calories. Unfortunately, eggs, and to a lesser extent meat, are a significant part of my diet. I would like to reduce my intake of these amino acids, or at least balance my overall amino acid intake, and have been including lots of gelatin in my diet, which is high in glycine and other amino acids, but almost completely free of methionine, cysteine, and tryptophan. If I reduce meat intake and keep eating gelatin and fish, I believe I can still maintain muscle development. I also supplement the amino acid leucine to build muscle. What are your thoughts regarding my desire to eat paleo, build muscle, and achieve my goal of longevity by avoiding these three amino acids?
Ooh, this is it sounds like a wacky question, but it's actually pretty good and some decent thinking going on here. You know, for a long time, the whole calorie restriction thing, we're looking mainly at calories, possibly at carbohydrate, and then it's looking more and more like protein, maybe a significant factor in this, particularly some mTOR signaling. At the end of the day, though, you know, Matt Lalonde and I talked about this stuff, and my gut sense, and we may modify this over time, but my gut sense on this, and I talked to Matt, I've talked to Chris Kresser, talked to some other folks about all this stuff. I think that to the degree that we're going to see really significant longevity improvements, you know, like if we just basically, it was the opinion of Lauren Cordain that if people avoided gluten, that we would probably bump the average lifespan of humans up to about Americans from 75 years average lifespan to 85 years average lifespan. Just like gluten is so pro-inflammatory and causes so many problems that, you know, we would on average bump the lifespan up to about an average of 85 years, you know, with modern medical intervention and all that stuff. But generally people would be much, much healthier along that whole course. He added the additional caveat that if people went full on paleo, did smart exercise, had good vitamin D levels, all that sort of stuff, that we would bump average lifespan to up to 95 years. So with some very, very simple interventions that are not austere, that are not limiting protein intake or anything like that, we could basically stick another 20 years potentially onto average lifespan for you know, like modern westernized humans, which to me seems like a shocking kind of return on investment. Like really minimal tweaking in your dietary practices and lifestyle, considering you get to eat steak and fish and, you know, lift weights and go to bed a little early and take some vitamin D, and all that stuff will kind of converge in a way that you could shift average lifespan from 75 years to 95 years. Now, from there, my gut sense is that to really get something quantitatively longer, we're going to have to do some pretty good austerity practices. You know, maybe intermittent fasting will help a little bit, but then we've got a little bit of a specter of like elevated cortisol hanging out on the back end. Maybe this protein partitioning where we're really, really trying to limit things that are triggering the mTOR pathway and some of these growth and proliferation pathways for a health and longevity perspective. Maybe you could do some of that stuff, but I'm not sure. It seems like we're getting really, really a flat line on the return on investment. Like we're starting to invest way, way more in my perspective, a much more marginal return. And it's not to say don't do this. It's not to say it won't work. But, you know, we have some pretty interesting insights into very long-lived people. And they just had this woman who's basically lives in the Amazon and, you know, horticulturalist, hunter-gatherer group, and she's like 124 years old. Obviously, she's always been active. She's always had good community. The food's been good. But I don't think that she's probably practiced like overt calorie restriction. She hasn't practiced overt protein partitioning the way that we're talking about here. Maybe she's eating more fish and small game versus like meat, and maybe that does shift the genetic expression a little bit on that mTOR pathway. But I guess for me, again, you know, if we focus on inflammation, we focus on vitamin D, we get some good sleep, we do some smart exercise, we have good stress control and all that. To me on that, you know, performance, health, longevity interface and trying to do minimum investment, maximum return, that seems like the goods to me. And again, that isn't, you know, to say maybe excluding eggs might buy you a little bit more, but my gut sense is that's the outer kind of fringe element where you're going to get really, really quick, easy returns with this other stuff. So I might modify that over time, but some of the modifications that we're talking about here, we're probably talking about potentially a smaller, less muscular, less dynamic diet and all the rest of that stuff. So I'm a little hesitant to recommend it. If folks want to play with it, that's totally cool. And I think we'll have a good idea on some biomarkers that we could track here in the next couple of years, so that if you're playing with something like this, we could say, okay, we see a gene expression, we see a proteomic expression, manufacturer proteins that are consistent with what we would expect to see in a long-lived individual. But obviously, we won't know until to the end of the run on that, whether or not this stuff actually plays out and is beneficial.
All right, well, all that being what it is, let's talk about something more important, and that is bacon.
Indeed.
Tom says, "Hi, Rob. Love the podcast and the Paleo Solution book. Can you clarify your opinion on the consumption of bacon? I see differing opinions from two respected experts, those being Matt Lalonde for and Lauren Cordain against it. Most other sites seem to be against bacon as a paleo-approved food, so I wanted to get your opinion. Also, is that not good if you have autoimmune like celiac? By the way, I would love to see you and Matt Lalonde do an extended video series, as you are both extremely smart and great speakers."
Matt has good hair too, so that would be a serious bonus. How do I want to tackle this? Lauren Cordain is my mentor. He's my close personal friend. But when he wrote his first book, I think a lot of the perspective was coming not so much from like a clinician perspective, like actually trying to get people to eat a particular way day in and day out. And when you look at, it's kind of interesting when you look at some of the academic oriented books that have been written, I would put Lauren's in that camp versus say like Mike and Mary Eads, who were physicians and working with people and trying to figure out, okay, how do I actually convince people to do this stuff? I would put myself more in the clinician than the academic kind of scene, because we owned a gym. And again, I'm trying to make a living, and one of the best ways to do that is to get people success. And it was interesting when I went through the original Paleo Diet book when it came out in 2001, you look at that stuff and there were some things like, don't use balsamic vinegar because of the acid load. Don't eat bacon because of the salt, again, for the acid load, but also because it was kind of high in saturated fat. Lauren has completely modified his stance on saturated fat. I just got a proof of his next book. I'm providing a little bit of editorial feedback on his next book, which should be due out somewhere around the first of the year. And he's really modified his stance on that. But there were a couple of things that I noticed when I started talking to people about application in their diet. And like bacon and like balsamic vinegar and salt were these things that were, you would get pretty good buy-in. And you'd sell people on paleo and celiac and all the rest of that stuff. And then as soon as you said, okay, no bacon because it's got a lot of salt and some, fatty acids, maybe squirrely, or you're going to use lemon juice instead of balsamic vinegar, people were like, F that, I'm done. And they were gone, like just, like ejector seat kind of gig. And so that was one thing that I was kind of like, okay, from a compliance standpoint, if I can get people off of like bagels and pizza and high fructose corn syrup and all the rest of it, and my trade-off is that we keep some balsamic vinegar and some bacon in the mix, that seems fine. Like I sat and really thought through like the biochemistry and fatty acid metabolism and all that stuff. And I was like, I can't really see a problem with this stuff one way or another. And if it's a deal breaker for people, then it seems silly to get freaked out on that point. And so that's my perspective on why I've always kept the bacon in there, to say nothing of the fact that it's delicious and amazing and kind of makes life worth living and all that, all those silly side details. So I don't see a problem with it, both from a fatty acid standpoint. There are some people that even when they're eating low carb, they do not respond well to sodium intake. They'll get a sodium-induced blood pressure increase. So those people are going to have to figure out what they're up to. They need to buy some low-sodium bacon, or they need to just keep an eye on that stuff. For autoimmunity and celiac, the bacon may or may not be a problem. There are some people that really are sick enough and kind of damaged enough that they need to stick with grass-fed meats. And so kind of along the line of when we had Kurt Harris on the podcast, he was only consuming mainly consuming grass-fed beef and grass-fed lamb. Some people may need to go that direction. So the fact that pork is, you know, even pastured pork, typically it's given some grains, that could be a problem for some people. But in general, for 99% of people, 90% of people, I don't think that's a problem. So that's my take on bacon. Greg, your thoughts on bacon?
I like it. I like eating it. And in all seriousness, I think it's one of those things that unless you have some kind of overt bad reaction to it, eating bacon every once in a while is certainly not going to kill you. And kind of with regard to the previous question about like Uber longevity and all this stuff, and you've made this point over and over again. It's like there's really no point in living to 125 if you're miserable for the last 50 of those years. You know what I mean? So having a little bit of bacon every once in a while is probably going to have you enjoy the years you do have more than you would being obsessively restrictive on your diet.
Yeah. Yeah.
In my humble opinion, from a guy who can pretty much eat anything and feel fine.
Right.
I apologize to those of you who have a little bit more trouble in that area than I do.
Damn you.
Okay. Well, here's a long one with big words. This might be tricky for me. It's early. Scott says, "Hi, guys. Sorry for the long question, but I feel it best to provide the full story. I'm a 30-year-old 100-meter track sprinter and former national and Pan-Pacific champion, and I've been sprinting since I was a young boy. I'm a relatively solid guy at 185 pounds and have very developed calf muscles. I've been paleo about 95% for about a year, although I kind of started moving towards it more like 2.5 years ago. Over the past few years, I've been experiencing calf cramps. I started out getting cramps at the end of my track sessions, which was annoying but not a huge problem. As the months went on, I would notice I was getting calf fasciculations at the end of my session. They would ripple and twitch with little spasms. I started getting cramps mid-session, and about a year ago, the cramps would actually occur even if I was doing an upper body workout in the gym. My calves would cramp. The fasciculations now happen all the time. In bed at rest and sitting at my desk, I have constant twitches. It feels like I have small creatures wriggling around in my calves. I've had my blood work done and all my levels are spot on. I've tried more magnesium and hydrating. No change. Since going paleo, I'm eating far less volume of carbs, whereas in my earlier sprinting years, I would eat oats, toast, fruit for breakfast, and more bread and carb snacks throughout the day. I'd be loaded with carbs. Could it be that my body is just in need of more glycogen stores? My typical breakfast is meat and 3 vegetables. Lunch is much the same. Ditto for dinner. I snack on nuts, berries, and dark chocolate, and maybe a piece of fruit. I feel amazing in terms of general health thanks to paleo, but the cramping and twitching is really getting me down. I should note that the cramping isn't completely restricted to my calves. Sometimes it can be in other muscles, but mostly in my calves, and the fasciculations are almost completely only in my calves. The cramping is so bad now that it's stopping me from competing and finishing my training sessions. What should I be eating as a sprinter to keep fueled for my track running and weight session? Any suggestions are greatly appreciated. If I can't sort this out with diet, then I guess I should see a neurologist. Thanks so much."
Shoot, I think the immediate place to look to this is just adding a bunch of paleo carbs back into the mix, you know, first. And yams, sweet potatoes, bananas, plantains. White potatoes in a pinch, take the peels off, and you pretty much make those like a pretty safe, benign starch. That would seems like the obvious place to go. If you know, I'm assuming you're probably pretty damn lean, and if you're pretty lean, then I think we start getting into some areas where without carbs, then you're gonna be in a quasi-ketogenic state all the time. That can have some problems with regards to like a calcium homeostasis, whether or not you're keeping calcium in or out of cells, and you might benefit from just throwing some carbs in. Like that's just the most immediate, quickest fix possible that I could see in this whole thing. It sounds like the magnesium supplementation hasn't really helped. I would get your vitamin D levels checked, make sure that those are good. Maybe add in some seaweed or like a kelp extract, 150 micrograms a day of iodine. That can be kind of a factor in this. A really tight paleo diet can be a little bit skinny in iodine if you're not eating some seafood here and there. But that's kind of the first place that I would look. I don't think we need a neurologist or anything. I think you're probably just eating a little bit too low of carb. Even you know, Mauro Di Pasquale, when he recommends the anabolic diet or the metabolic diet for folks, you know, and he has really good success with sprinters and track and field athletes with that. It's a cyclic low carb diet, but again, it's cyclic. And if you're having any type of performance goofiness, he has a really slick flow chart that's basically like, if you're very, very well fat adapted and you're not having performance declination, then you stick to having a carb refeeds on the weekends. If you start having some problems with performance, then you start having more frequent carb refeeds. And it's a pretty simple gig. And this is one of those things that, just as an aside, that I've always been a little bit reticent or had difficulties recommending the zone, or even, you know, getting in and weighing and measuring food all that much. Yeah, it brings some accuracy and precision to the game. If we're going to run a scientific study, that's great. We should weigh and measure our food. But, you know, both Greg and I and got tons of coaches, Poliquin being one of the primary folks, Mauro Di Pasquale, just simply looking kind of big macro view at what folks are doing. And if we see some problems with performance, you know, if somebody's not gaining muscle mass and we assume that their digestion is okay, then we up calories and we up protein. If somebody's not really recovering from training, then we up carbohydrate probably and possibly overall, you know, caloric content. And so it doesn't require that much fastidiousness to be able to tweak things in a way where we get some very, very high level performance. But I'm suspecting that you're probably feeling good. Yeah, good blood sugar control, and that's all great. But given the volume of the training that you're doing, the intensity of the training, I bet you're running too low on carbs, and you'll know if that's the fixative immediately.
I weighed my food one time a couple weeks ago, and it was exactly 1 kilo. I will not speak to the composition of that 1 kilo, but it was delicious. All right.
It sounds like a cocaine crusted nachos or something like that.
Speaking of cocaine and weightlifters, what's his name? Galibin Boevski was a world champion for Bulgaria. Just got busted, I think, in like the Sao Paulo airport with 9 kilos of coke.
Holy cat.
So good luck to him. I hope for the best. I hope he can get a good lawyer.
Dude,
I'm sure it was just he was holding it for a friend. So
I was holding it for my aunt, I swear.
Yeah.
Wow.
All right. This guy's name is Womp. That's weird. Hey guys, for basically as long as I can remember, I've binged on junk food, mainly sugary crap. One of my earliest memories is sitting under a coffee table in my mom's office eating what I thought were delightful candies, but which I later learned were simply sugar cubes for the coffee. I've quite literally eaten sheet cake until I vomited. Any amount of sheet cake will usually make you vomit. It's pretty gross.
Yeah, it's kind of what it's made for. Yeah.
When I started drinking in college, I began drinking just like I tended to eat candy. That is to say, I drank a lot until I vomited. That sounds like college, too. At this point, however, I get sick from candy
I just have to throw in here, we really, in the show notes, should put in the Family Guy Epicac episode. In this one. We just got to. We got to put that in there.
Oh, man. That okay. It's pretty incredible. And for those of you who haven't seen it, why have you not seen it?
It is amazing.
When I have a drink, it seems to energize me. I end up staying up all night, and I usually put away ungodly amounts of junk food in the process. Now, judging by the amount I drink, I would definitely qualify as an alcoholic. But I've known alcoholics, and my drinking seems to be of a very different nature. I never get into trouble. There's no discernible psychological cause, etc. I just like to drink a lot. My desire to drink alcohol feels almost exactly like the same as my desire to eat candy. I recently gave up drinking for a year to see if I could. It wasn't that hard for me, but I think I just replaced the alcohol with candy. And when I've gone cold turkey on the booze and candy for a while, I usually end up drinking stupid amounts of coffee instead, day and night. I was wondering if you could explain what mechanisms might be at play here. How might binge eating carbohydrates be related to binge drinking alcohol? And how are these related to binge drinking coffee as a substitute? And most importantly, is it theoretically possible to eliminate the desire to binge on these substances with a very low-carb paleo diet? How would that work? By the way, I'm a 30-year-old male, roughly 40 pounds overweight. Finally, I want to thank Rob for all the great work he's done. I've turned a number of people onto his book recently. My 68-year-old father claims he feels better than he has in ages as a result of Rob's advice. I, on the other hand, have been too busy binging on candy and alcohol to actually follow any of Rob's advice. I just read a lot about it instead. I'm hoping a better understanding of why I binge might be the final push I need. Thanks again. This guy sounds like he'd be fun to hang out with.
Absolutely. Like, we're going to try to get you off the booze, but if you don't, let us know where you live, and Greg and I will come hang out, or we'll meet in Vegas and just, you know, have like a stripper and booze fund, and we'll go wild. So, you know, I'm by no means an expert on neurophysiology, the neurophys of addiction and stuff like that, but I do know there are certain foods that normally release serotonin. Typically, alcohol is kind of a serotonin releaser, so it tends to sedate you. Alcohol is kind of wacky in that it will play up certain elements of the sympathetic nervous system in folks typically, and then hit other elements of the parasympathetic nervous system. So it's both stimulatory and inhibitory in certain ways. And that's why it's kind of funny with erections and sex and stuff like that, because alcohol makes you feel randy, but it makes your weenie not work. So it's kind of a funny deal with that. But typically,
there's nothing funny about that, Rob.
No, there's nothing funny about that. So.
That's like a Sisyphus sort of thing.
That's grounds for dismissal there. Yeah, it is very Sisyphusian in that regard. Touché. You know, with people who, you know, like you have some folks that, like, the first time they try booze, the first time, we'll focus on booze because I was going to mention cocaine or something like that. But cocaine is understood to be a dopamine stimulator right out of the gate. But the deal with some folks who consume alcohol, and I would stick carbohydrate in this also, typically carbohydrate is more serotonin promoting than it is dopamine promoting. But in some people, alcohol promotes dopamine release. I'm suspecting that some people, they get more of a dopamine release out of a junk food like a sugar. And for those people, this thing is much, much more addictive. Like, almost anybody can consume alcohol to a frequency and a level in which they become physiologically addicted to the alcohol. But for some people, the likelihood of you going to that place is almost immediate. It's kind of interesting, though, like you've mentioned that you've been able to fork over booze, but then you end up kind of substituting other stuff. So I think that we've got some kind of dopamine deficient kind of baseline, which I would probably put myself in that area too. Like, when I think about the tendency that I've had in the past for like extreme behaviors, you know, like riding a motorcycle in a wheelie for a mile and doing bungee jumping and rock climbing and kickboxing, and I've had my terror of binge shrieking. It took me a long time to figure out that I could have two drinks and stop, because I'm such a extreme personality type that I'd have two and then the inhibitions would drop, and then it was like 20, and I was always the dude that was like face down under a bush at the end of the party. You know, it's like I never finished a party standing. It was always like a complete catastrophe. So I really understand this stuff. And over the course of time, I think that it definitely is very dopamine related. I think that this is a lot of why early on when I first adopted a ketogenic, or at least a cyclic ketogenic version of a paleo type diet, like, it was just amazing for me. The angels just sang for the first time in my life. Everything was clear. I could think. I had impulse control. And really, my desire for and interest in alcohol really decreased a lot after that. And, you know, I'll drink a little bit now, but the desire for it is just not at all what it was. But, you know, early on, I knew that I probably, because of my looking at my parents, I probably had a high propensity for addictive behaviors. That's why this kid never really played around with the white drugs, because I was like, dude, I'll be I'll be doing hand jobs down on the mission district to pay for my addiction here in no time. So I think that there's a lot of potent neurophysiology here. And I would really, you know, given what you've laid out here, I would be really surprised if kind of a ketogenic or quasi-ketogenic diet did not really improve the symptomology with this stuff. It might not. Some people, they just don't do really well on a real low-carb diet. I suspect that you would have a hellish transition, like absolutely hellish. But I think if you could pop through the end of it and get, you know, 7 to 10 days in a much lower carbohydrate intake, I think you'd start feeling a lot better. As I'm talking about this, I'm remembering some recent research where they put people on some drugs commonly used to get folks off of either cocaine or heroin, and it was very, very effective at helping people with food addiction, you know, particularly like junk food addiction. Nobody binge eats on like pork spare ribs and stuff. I mean, I try to, Steve but Pan, you know, Steve Pan does, but he binge eats on everything. Yeah. So but typically it's the same thing. It's like sugary food or, you know, these high reward trigger foods that folks are having a problem with, and not surprisingly, they have some effects on like the dopamine and opiate receptor sites in the brain, and kind of get that whole feed forward reward mechanism going. So there's something to it. It sounds like you're wired up in this way, and it's kind of it's funny in a way. When I look back at my life when I did more extreme stuff, I can't say I was happier. Because I like a mellower existence. I don't like having insane girlfriends in my life. You know, it's like there's all these things that kind of go together with this stuff. Because when you're in fights and when you're almost dying from riding a motorcycle at 150 miles an hour and stuff like that, you feel very, very alive. But there's obviously a lot of cost associated with a lifestyle like that. But I think some people are just wired up neurologically that they need that constant really high input, either from physical activity, risk taking, or kind of substance abuse type stuff. And it's taken me a long time to figure out how to get to a point in my life where I can have like a good productive relationship and not shoot myself in the foot all the time with you know, counterproductive behavior. Hasn't been easy.
Yes. Well, you're a better person for it.
That's the theory.
At least I feel like that's what I'm supposed to say.
And then as we go offline, it's like, dude, you're so boring.
Yeah, growing up is stupid.
All I can say is luckily Greg and I did not know each other in our youth.
We would probably not be doing this right now.
We would be dead. Yeah. Because Greg and my exploits combined would have been deadly.
But incredible.
And incredibly fun.
All right. Well, speaking of exploits, Amy has a question about birth control. Hey, Rob. First, love the use. Oh, geez. This one's a little screwed up, so give me a second here to orient myself. First, love the use of the phrase cock block in the latest podcast. I think it's been in at least a couple dozen podcasts, but I was wondering if you could address the effects of probiotics on birth control pills. I know you have a ton of requests/tweets. Here was our brief Twitter exchange. Would love a follow-up. I'm currently not taking probiotics out of concern over this, but would like to. Loving the paleo life. Down 15 pounds and kicking ass physically and mentally. Thanks so much. And I'm not going to read the twatter thing because it's, well, it reads like Twitter stuff.
Yeah. Okay, first, Amy, quit stalking me. No, I'm just kidding. Amy has pinged me a couple of times on this. So I did some poking around on this stuff, and I haven't seen anything really conclusive on bacterial or gut probiota changes in different birth control pills. But the thing with that is that you've got a slew of different types of birth control pills. You've got estradiol only, you've got estrogen plus progesterone. All these things get metabolized differently. So it's a fairly complex story. I wouldn't really worry about it so much. Like, we know that there's such a huge benefit from probiotics. One, that I think that that's a huge deal. And two, we also know for a fact that birth control pills can and tend to alter gut bacteria in a way that really isn't that favorable. And so I would tend to, you know, do some stuff like sauerkraut or get a good probiotic from like New Chapter or something like that. And I would run with that stuff. I wouldn't worry about it, you know, like blocking the effects of the various types of birth control pills. Now, that said, we're just in this emergent point in history where we're understanding that the types of gut bacteria may dramatically influence the way that different drugs are metabolized. There's a whole lot of drugs that we consume, as well as food constituents, which are dramatically changed from the time that we put it in our mouth. Like we have one chemical. When we put it in our mouth, when it hits the gut, it gets turned into a different chemical because of bacterial action. And it may have three or four or five steps with that. A lot of different herbal things actually undergo a remarkable change from the point where we ingest it in our mouth to the point where it actually gets into our system. And it's not the same chemical at all. It's been metabolized and modified by gut bacteria. And dude, it's just the Wild West. I mean, as it is right now, we have an understanding that pharmaceuticals have different effects on people based on their different genetic profile. Then we add into that the fact that that can be modified based on activity levels, different nutrient profiles, vitamin D, you know, B vitamins, vitamin A, all that stuff. That can change drug kinetics and metabolism. Then you add the additional caveat into this thing that gut bacteria can modify the metabolism of these constituents. And so it's a very, very complex process. We're in an infantile stage of understanding with most of it. But I, by and large, I would stick with using probiotic supplementation is kind of the long and short of all that stuff.
Yeah, I thought antibiotics were supposed to make birth control ineffective.
And they can potentially because of the impact on gut bacteria. So that's where there may be some metabolic steps that the gut bacteria catalyze in this. But again, like we've got a bunch of different types of birth control that can be used when you're doing oral birth control. And so it'll kind of depend on what variety you're using, what type of gut bacteria you have, and then what the downstream effects of that can be.
Okay.
But this could be an argument for something like Depo-Provera or something like that, where we bypass the gut interface entirely, you know, where they're doing the subcutaneous administration of that.
Just make sure the girl's on top, then she can't get pregnant.
Exactly.
Tyler says, kids, don't try that. It's not true. Tyler says, first, thanks so much for the podcast, a priceless resource that's free. Thank you so much. I've been listening to the podcast for several months now. Within that time, my wife and I had our first child, a baby boy. Congratulations, Tyler. Based on everything that I could find on the internet, websites, forums, blogs, etc., it's obvious that breast milk is the best way to go. However, my wife is needing surgery, which will be when our son is 3 to 4 months old, but it also means that she will not be able to breastfeed after the surgery because of some post-surgery meds and procedures. So we will have to provide some sort of formula or nutrition for our son. As I've looked into baby formulas, all the formulas that I've looked at have sweeteners, soy products, and most are dairy-based. So I feel like I just can't trust a commercial baby formula. Is a paleo baby formula possible? As for adults, we generally avoid grains, legumes, and dairy, with some exceptions. But is that the same dietary guideline for infants/babies? It seems like paleo guidelines do not apply to infants/babies. Is it safe to say/assume, since babies primarily eat breast milk? I've been searching the web for homemade baby formula. I thought I found something good on the Weston A. Price website, and there's a link here we'll put on the notes. I thought the liver-based baby formula would be the way to go, but after reading some of the comments, my wife and I are not 100% confident with the liver-based formula or the other suggested formulas on the Weston A. Price website, partly because of amounts of vitamins and minerals that are way above that found in breast milk. Is the Weston A. Price website a good resource for baby formula? If so, is the cow's milk, goat's milk, or liver-based formula the best option? If the Weston A. Price website is not the best resource for a homemade baby formula, then do you have a homemade baby formula recipe or know of a good resource to get one? Thank you so much for your time and any information you can offer. I feel like I just said Weston A. Price like 400 times.
And that's a mouthful under any circumstances. So, one thought, and I would bounce this off of your pediatrician, one thought is before your wife goes in for surgery, could you potentially bank a lot of milk, do some preemptive pumping, freeze it, and then thaw it out later and use it? But I would bounce that off your doc and make sure that sounds like a kosher, reasonable idea. From there, I think the Weston A. Price stuff is pretty legit. I would also really, really recommend that you check out Chris Kresser's Healthy Baby Code. I've got a link to it on my website. I get a little affiliate pinger when folks buy that through the website. It is phenomenal, and he covers a lot of this stuff. And a lot of the first foods that he recommends are things like egg yolks and a liver-based kind of pate puree kind of gig. Personally, I would lean towards that in deference to the milk-based products, just because I am nervous of some of the autoimmune potential complications from any type of other mammalian dairy that we're taking in. Maybe I'm a nutcase. Maybe I'll modify my stance on that. But just looking at the literature, also looking at the instance of colic in babies that are being given milk and or when the mom is consuming milk, it just seems to happen constantly. And I don't know if that's a reflection of people not getting grass-fed dairy because we've got some lectins and some other pro-inflammatory constituents in a standard dairy. So I'm just nervous about that personally. So I would kind of lean towards that stuff. So I guess kind of to answer the specific questions, I think the Weston Price stuff is solid. I would lean more towards the liver-based products, and I would definitely check out the Healthy Baby Code, and I would bounce off of your doc the idea of potentially trying to bank a month or more of breast milk and see if you can freeze it and, give an aliquot and then thaw it out and use it and see if that all makes sense. And that's all cool from like a hygiene, bacterial overgrowth kind of perspective. Are there any considerations that I'm not thinking through on that? So talk to your doc and make sure that that's all cool. He or she may be like, absolutely not. That's insane. Don't do it. And so like, obviously, defer to them on that topic, but, check out Chris Kresser and, it'd be interesting to see what you do and see what the results are. I know a lot of people are in the same situation. These problems pop up, and so it'd be great to get your feedback and let us know what you did so that we've at least got one kind of path through the wilderness that somebody has done so that other folks can look at it and have a template.
All right. Paul says...
This one's great.
Rob, love the podcast. Lukewarm on your book.
Which is hilarious to me. Like, the book is so much better than the podcast.
Maybe have Greg co-author next time. What a dick. Paul, I love that last sentence, but I'm lukewarm on the first one. Straight to my question. That's not really straight to your question. To what extent is the, quote, paleo term holding back the paleo movement from taking off and changing even more lives? Found paleo less than 6 months ago through CrossFit. Since I turned primal, I lost a ton of weight, about 50 pounds, and have experienced all the other stereotypical paleo benefits. More energy, stronger, faster, better skin, and even helped what could have been a mild case of depression. Who knows on that last one? Reading this recent Whole 9 post, something about nutrition in 60 seconds, about how we as paleo-ers describe our nutrition/lifestyle got me thinking about my own experience and how the whole paleo/primal concept just immediately turns people off or otherwise sends the message in an entirely different direction. As if my family couldn't just look at the changes in my body composition and overall level of happiness and want to hear more. Instead, I get the predictable caveman only lived 35 years response. So while I fully get that evolutionary biology is central to this whole thing, is it time to ditch the paleo label in order to reach more people? Not to mention getting people away from the stupid debates about what is or is not paleo. Your loyal follower, Paul.
This is a really interesting question. And like I rattle this stuff around a lot. When I finished my the first book, it was kind of funny. I I was kind of like, okay, there it is. It's done. Everybody in the world needs to read it. And now I'll become a coconut farmer in Nicaragua and I don't need to do anything else. And I literally had a month, I remember it was about this time last year that we put up that post, "What do y'all need?" where we asked, you know, what do you guys need? And, you know, there were some things like transcribing the podcasts and some different things, which we've done so that we can help serve people better and all that sort of stuff. But I was remarkably naive in my assumption that, you know, my book was going to be the final, I wouldn't say the final or definitive answer or anything, but it, you know, from my perspective, it was kind of like, shoot, if you read my book, Protein Power Life Plan or Primal Blueprint or something like that, dude, 99% of all the questions are answered. 99% of people's issues are dealt with if they'll just do it. But, you know, beyond that, how to wrap and package this, I'm not really sure. I would throw back to Paul, if you work with people in any type of day-to-day capacity, whether it's in a gym, it's in a clinical setting as a physician, doing a blog or a podcast where you're trying to educate and help people on this stuff, you are always going to have some sort of confusion, some sort of pushback. Shoot, if you go to vegan websites and they're trying to get people to eat vegan, then, you know, people will raise the question, well, won't I be protein deficient? Won't I be vitamin deficient and everything? And, you know, and they've got their answers to that, and they've got to do their education and everything. So there's always going to be some sort of an educational component to all this stuff, because there's a bunch of different, you know, ideas and theories out there and all the rest of it. And, you know, I've thought about this. I'm like, okay, does it need to become the wolf pack diet? And John Wellborn is trying to rebrand his stuff and call what he's doing the power athlete diet, because he has paleo plus dairy. And I tease him incessantly about it, you know, but it's cool. You know, he's kind of branding this thing, and it streamlines the whole process, and he's kind of de-emphasizing the evolution kind of background and historical revisionism and all that stuff. We could build most of these arguments from molecular biology up, but then you're driving people in a way where they need to be pretty sophisticated on like digestion and endocrinology and all the rest of that. And then it still kind of begs the question, are all carbohydrates bad? Yes, they are. No, they're not. You know, it depends on which camp you're in. So for me, this evolutionary template, some people freak out. Other people, it makes absolute, completely, complete sense for them, and they buy in immediately. But the thing is I've pushed things from just simply the low carb perspective, and you end up in an educational process. But just simply saying low carb doesn't really address a bunch of these issues related to gluten intolerance and lectins and anti-nutrients and all the rest of that jive. So I think the buy-in, you know, the long and short story of this is that it's a fairly complex topic. If people really want to understand what's going on, there's a little bit of education associated with it. Some people are going to buy in. Some people are going to buy in with some bludgeoning, and some people are never going to buy in, no matter what type of a situation they're in, or, you know, what type of information you present to them. So I'm open to rebranding it. If somebody has a great idea for it, then let's do it. But I still have not seen something that's better than like the paleo prime. I actually kind of like primal a little better. It doesn't seem to send people into quite as big a fits of reactionism. Although I think like Mark Sisson gets plenty of the cavemen live 35 years kind of gig. Some people are just fucking morons. They just want to argue sometimes, you know, and that's where I'm very hands off on the sales pitch. I put it out there. I'm completely focused on helping the smart people. We'll try to get the smart people to out reproduce the dumb people. And, you know, maybe by the time my grandkids hit the scene, what's that movie that Idiocracy, is that what it is? Where, you know, where the complete, you know, all the liberal college educated people hold off having kids, and they can never get pregnant, and so they end up getting bred out by all the trailer trash and everything. And it's kind of true in a way. And so to some degree, I'm just very much like grab the people who want to be helped, focus on them, and kind of go from there. And again, having been in this scene since 1998, and when it was as fringe as it could possibly be, and nobody was into it, and nobody understood any of this stuff, whereas now we've got a massive social network explosion. The paleo primal concept is in every single media outlet. And so to some degree, I would tell the Johnny Come Latelys and Paul, throw you in that camp. You just need to kind of cool your jets a little bit. Like, I've been doing this a long, long time, and the thing is absolutely exploding, absolutely taking off, and that seems like kind of a dumb time to rebrand it and just kind of chuck all of the sweat equity that we've had in this thing thus far. But there again, if you've got a different rebranding and you've got a different way of doing this where you can get all of the efficacy, you know, get all of the benefits, cover autoimmunity, cover, athletic performance, talk about sustainability, blah, 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 you know, wrap all this stuff together, then by all means do it. I just haven't seen that yet. And we seem to be in the midst, literally, of this stuff exploding. So do I wish that it was easier? Yeah, I guess I wish it was easier. But then again, I guess in some ways it's kind of job security for me. There's always going to be pushback, so there's always going to be a need to educate. So I guess that's good. I just try not to obscure the message, just to try to make my job even more secure, because I feel like, again, there are enough morons out there that my job is secure for the rest of my life. Like, I have anxiety. I think I've mentioned this stuff before. I have anxiety at night going to bed trying to figure out, how do I get this message out just to more people? And it's not necessarily changing the message, although, you know, like, if I could refine the message and break it down into simpler steps and stuff like that, that would be great. But there's also a basic reality that you, and I talked about this in my book, which Paul was lukewarm about, but, you know, I talked about this. 50% of people are going to buy into this thing immediately. You tell them, hey, we're going to try this paleo-type diet. It's kind of lower carb. It's going to get you lean. You'll look good. You'll get a lot of pull-ups. Great. People buy in. Boom. They're done. Of the remaining 50% of people, about half of those folks, we need to beg and threaten and cajole to get bought in. But eventually, we usually get them bought in. So we're up to about maybe like 75% of the population. And then we've got about 25% of the population that, again, they're just not going to buy in. And they're going to argue, and they're going to be some sort of an armchair expert. And Nikki's cousin's husband is this guy that absolutely comes to mind with this. He was always like, oh, balance and nothing in extremes and everything, which is just horseshit. So those people, they can go do what they're going to do, and they're probably going to be sick and not as healthy, and that's fine. I'm not going to waste time on them. So I think about this stuff a lot. I wonder if there's a better way to rebrand it. I'm not seeing that there is. I'm completely open to it. But then at the same time, we're in a point where there's a whole lot of time and energy that's been put into building whatever this branded thing is and this concept. And we just need to understand that there's going to be some pushback and there's going to be some buy-in. And that's just the reality of things. And that's not really going to change. It's still my opinion that, we don't have arguments about shit like this in physics or engineering, and it's because those things are built upon robust, established sciences. And in the nutritional sciences and exercise science, in a lot of medical related areas, we still do not have evolutionary biology as the basic epistemological template that we look at things to be able to to just assess, is this question even worth asking? Like, does it even start begging a look from an evolutionary biology perspective? And because of that lack, we have all this gnashing of teeth and all this different stuff going on. So if it turns me into a Luddite or makes me superfluous at some point, I guess I'll get removed out of the system. But I'm pretty staunchly committed to trying to educate people about the reality of where we come from and where our food comes from and where our place is in the world. And part of that is an educational process. And some of that's going to be somewhat uncomfortable, and we're going to lose some people along the way. And that's fine. We're just not going to save everybody.
Yeah, I think, Paul, it's really easy as a practitioner and on an individual personal level to pitch this stuff to people without the brand name or without any kind of rigid terminology. You know, you can tell your family, hey, I'm eating this, I'm not eating this, and they can try it out. You know, as a gym owner, I can tell my clients, hey, why don't you try this? I don't have to say, I want to put you on the paleo diet. I don't say that because I don't like saying that. I don't like branding any diet because it can be off-putting for people. I do understand what you're saying. But at the same time, on a very broad scale, like what we're talking about here, you have to package this stuff somehow or it's impossible to get the information out there. There's no way to do it. So you have to have some kind of simple terminology that allows you to, is a vehicle for this stuff.
And the reason for that is that some people are going to ask why.
Yeah.
And then you're going to need to start building things up. And again, you could try to build it from the molecular foundations up and look at endocrinology and look at digestive physiology and all the rest of that. And that's maybe a legitimate way to go and just look at like the incompatibility of grains, you know, because they cause gut damage. But again, this always then people will say, well, why do grains have that? Why is that a problem? And then it's like, well, they evolved to have anti-predation chemicals in them. So it's kind of like asking, you know, talking to a kid who's like, why? And eventually you have to get down to brass tacks at some point. You know, why is the sky blue? Well, the light that comes through the atmosphere gets scattered. And because of the makeup of oxygen and nitrogen in our atmosphere and all the rest of that, the scattering effect creates a typically blue color that we perceive, but it's a light scattering effect. That's the why. And, again, like Greg said, we don't necessarily have to lead in with the why. And again, with my book, I told people, if you don't care about why you do it, and you just want to reap the results, then skip to the implementation chapter and do it. But for the love of God, you had better not come back to me asking why questions, because I'm going to pop you in the nose, because you had an opportunity to read the science and to understand it and to get the whys answered up front on your own dime, not on mine.
So I, like Paul, in your situation, I guess I just don't. I don't see the problem. You're talking about trying to convince your family to do it. Well, then do exactly what you're talking about. Let them see how it's worked for you and then provide them the information on how to implement it. Help them do it. Give them the support. You never have to use the word paleo. No one's telling you have to. So I guess I just don't see what you're upset about. Aside from the fact that Rob's book was terrible.
Yeah, apparently my book sucked. So, this is also when there's things, the likelihood of you getting your family to buy in is like, that is the last place you should look for the first level of buy-in. Like they just don't do it. So our family always thinks that we're a moron, and they're partially right and partially wrong. And there you go.
Mainly right. All right. Well, that extra bit of coffee definitely pushed that one over the time edge for us. So let's wrap it up there. On a nice positive note.
a beat deal.
Yes.
Cool. So let's see here. I'm trying to think of anything that's going on, but you know, Greg's got some sort of nefarious stuff that we'll learn about at some later date, and I'm moving to Reno, and hopefully everybody's doing good.
Yeah.
Cool. Sweet. All right, man. Thanks, G. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. See you
later, dude.